From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. As the leaders of the nations of the Americas prepare to sit down in Panama City this weekend for the Summit of the Americas, Venezuela's President Nicolas Maduro will have a present for the American President Barack Obama, a petition calling for a reversal of the U.S. President's executive order declaring the Bolivarian Socialist Republic's government as a threat to national security. Telesur's Cody Weddle has more.
The international campaign against Washington's decree on Venezuela continues to gather steam. Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro says over 9 million signatures have been gathered in Venezuela alone. The petition demands that U.S. President Barack Obama revoke his presidential order that declares Venezuela a threat to U.S. national security. It's seen by millions as a blatant aggression against Venezuela, the decree. The signatures will be presented at the summit in Panama on Friday.
At noon today, we have arrived at 9,182,432 commitments willingly signed by the men and women of Venezuela. 9,182,000 at noon today. We are heading towards 10 million, and as I have said, even more.
There has been some backtracking by the White House. One aide said that the language that termed Venezuela a threat to national security was merely boilerplate used when sanctions are being sought. But Venezuela's foreign minister said it's actually evidence of the power of unity among Latin American nations.
They have said that Venezuela is not a threat to the national security of the United States, that this is about language. But I want to call attention to the fact that Venezuela has had unanimous support in the face of this imperialist arrogance from around the world and from regional alliances such as CELAC, ALBA, UNASUR, the Non-Aligned Movement, the G77 plus China. This unanimous support from social movements around the world who have added their signatures has caused quite a stir.
The government of Syria has offered to assist Palestinian refugees in Yarmouk who have been under siege by ISIS. Press TV's Hassan Tavakoli has more.
Syria's Deputy Foreign Minister Faisal Mehrdad, who met with the PLO delegation in Damascus, said the two sides are determined to fight terrorism which has reached Yarmouk camp. He also said the government and the Palestine Liberation Organization have agreed on the need for a unified position for the Palestinian forces in Syria. A PLO official said Syrian authorities are ready to support the Palestinian fighters militarily. A meeting among Syria's Palestinian factions is set for Wednesday to discuss a broader consensus. ISIL terrorists mounted a deadly attack on Yarmouk refugee camp, which houses some 18,000 Palestinians, on April the 1st. Over 2,000 refugees have been evacuated by the help of the Syrian army.
It's been two full weeks since Saudi Arabia began its air war on Yemen. As of Wednesday, Saudi-led warplanes had been raining down missiles on that country for 14 days, bringing the war-torn nation further misery and destruction. Press TV's Bardia Hanadar has more.
In the latest attack, Saudi-led fighter jets have targeted several gas stations and a military base in the governorate of Baida. Warplanes have also pounded different regions in Mahouid governorate. There have also been military aircraft flying over Amran governorate. More than 230 people, mostly civilians, have been killed since the start of the invasion. The UN says the aggression has also forced over 100,000 people to flee their homes.
Here in the West, the fighting in Yemen is seen as a proxy battle between the Saudi royal family and Iran. But from the leadership in Tehran, the call has been for an end to fighting and a political solution designed by and for Yemenis only. Press TV's Hassan Tavakoli reports.
The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, says ending attacks and foreign intervention in Yemen is the solution to the current crisis there. In a meeting with visiting Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan, Ayatollah Khamenei emphasized that it's only the people of Yemen who should decide about their own future. He says the conflicts that have affected the region are plots hatched by the enemies of Islam to disrupt a growing wave of Islamic awakening. The leader noted that Muslim countries will never benefit from relying on the West, including the U.S. Ayatollah Khamenei says the main proof for this is the West's hidden hand in all regional conflicts. Erdogan earlier met with Iran's President Hassan Rouhani.
Ukraine will sign a set of agreements with NATO on military and technical cooperation in intelligence, surveillance, and other areas that, according to Ukrainian Prime Minister Arseniy Yatsenyuk, Wednesday. According to a report in the Russian news agency TASS, Yatsenyuk said that Kiev and NATO will sign a memorandum of cooperation in, quote, control, communications, intelligence, and surveillance, closed quote, under NATO's Partnership for Peace program. Yatsenyuk added that another agreement would see the implementation of additional projects, including military and technical cooperation, communications, and new information technologies. Russia's President Vladimir Putin met with Greece's Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras in Moscow Wednesday, with many openly speculating about the possibility of a Russian role in a bailout for Athens. Putin said, when asked by a journalist whether Russia could help Greece with its debt burden, that no such assistance had been requested. However, he then laid out details of a number of agreements reached between the two that could provide substantial assistance to the Hellenic Republic, including the purchase by Russia of some of the assets Greece is being forced to sell off to satisfy its EU creditors. RT's Daniel Bichel has been following the talks and filed this report.
This is the meeting Eurocrats were biting their nails over, top Brussels and German politicians issuing threats and warnings to Athens not to get help from Russia here on fears Greece could start moving out the EU's grip. So what did they announce? Overall, there was a very positive tone looking to the future. Vladimir Putin said the sides agreed to expand trade again after Russia-Greece turnover slumped 40% last year from EU sanctions. But Athens, quote, did not ask Russia for help in terms of a loan to help pay off IMF debts. They did discuss loans for specific investment projects within Greece, particularly infrastructure such as transport, oil and gas, adding Athens could use that money to pay off those debts. Russia's president also gave more details on the new Turkish Stream gas pipeline from Russia to Europe, making Greece a, quote, transit hub, bringing millions in profit to the country.
The new route will supply the Europeans' needs for fuel and will let Greece become one of the main energy hubs on the continent.
Tsipras said he also wanted maximal Greek participation in that new pipeline. He added Greece will do, quote, all it can to act as a bridge for Russian dialogue with Brussels, expressing hopes for a thaw or, quote, spring in relations. As for sanctions, another fear widely expressed in mainstream media is Greece could break EU sanctions against Russia. Tsipras reiterated Greece doesn't like the policy of sanctions, slamming it as economic warfare. The problem is one state can't just remove them unilaterally. There's limits to what EU members can do. And vice versa, Putin said it's hard to make sanctions exceptions for any single EU country.
Joaquin Flores is a former labor union business agent who now heads the Center for Syncretic Studies in Belgrade, Serbia. He's an editor for Fort Rus, a news site focused on Russia. We spoke with him via Skype from Belgrade Wednesday. I wanted to speak with you about both the visit of the Greek Prime Minister to Moscow in the context of Greece's negotiations over restructuring of their debt. After we work through that, I wanted to talk about the machinations around this, the coming Victory Day parade in Moscow in May, which, you know, although just a, you know, just a cultural event, there has some pretty significant political overtones that actually relate to the situation between Greece and Germany on the one hand and Greece and Russia on the other, and the whole relationship between the one bloc on the one hand and the apparently forming bloc on the other. So let's start with the visit by Tsipras to Moscow and talk about that a little. What do you think is going on there?
You know, my general, thanks for having me, by the way. I'm glad to talk to you.
Thank you.
You know, my general sense of these sorts of things is that they move in stages, right? They move in phases. So normally what will happen, and I think we've already seen this, is there will be a lot of hype about what might be said. And I think that some of this is planted by sources unofficially, say, from Russia or from Greece. And these kind of like work as test balloons. Then they see who reacts and how they react. And then later on, when they really formulate their solution or their deal, they incorporate a lot of these initial criticisms into how they formulate it and how they advertise it, so that by the time that they do roll it out, it's, you know, more bulletproof.
Mm. Yeah, so, I mean, that's, you know, something you would expect in terms of negotiations anyway, and particularly things that have a leg in politics. Public support, public perception, all those things do have some weight, if not being determinative. Greece is looking at this huge nut that they have to meet again. I think it's either today or tomorrow, of about 250 million euros, roughly. And
right, it's tomorrow, and I think there's a couple of things that are due. It might be over 400 million, Don.
Yeah.
That's due tomorrow.
Yeah, it's a lot, that's as against a giant nut that they owe 320 something billion euros, and the bulk of that actually having been just a continual rolling over and restructuring of previous debt. There hasn't even been an added value to the Greek economy over most of that, and they're carrying that load. And by the way, that being owed by a country with a population of about 11 million people, so you have a debt load of about $11,000 or 11,000 euros per man, woman, and child in Greece.
Right.
But
I mean, there are Greek billionaires who got rich during this period of time. A lot of these loans were lent to private Greek lending institutions, which the same European banks that bankroll the ECB are also getting a piece of the action. So it's kind of like they lent money to themselves, but said, we're going to have Greek people pay the interest.
Right. Nice business if you can get it, huh? Jeez.
Sign me up, right.
Yeah. So, all right, then you have shaping up outside, you know, as context to this. I mean, you have before successive Greek governments, whether of the right or the nominal left, that were accepting the regime of austerity and trying basically different methods politically to sell it, or in any event sell acquiescence to it to the Greek people, and that started to unravel, and we saw the rise of Syriza, and then the election of Syriza this year on, campaigning against it with a perception among the voters that helped put them in, that they would either walk from the debt or, in other ways, just renounce it. And that may or may not be what they planned, but there were some people and there's some constituency actually in favor of that on the ground in Greece, although maybe not a majority yet. Now, the context, though, is that all of that was operating in a closed system before, where there was no place else to go. You either renounce the debt and walk, and now you're a pariah, or you take on an ever-increasing load. These new, you know, the new multipolarity that's rising in the world, including the new institutions of the BRICS groups, and the fact that you have China awash in all kinds of financial instruments and cash, by the way, and Russia actually having a considerable amount of cash on hand as well, and a geopolitical condition where perhaps making overtures to Greece by Russia and China, and then ultimately to Spain, maybe Portugal, Italy, Hungary, who knows what, where else, that the possibility is opening up for alternatives as far as Greece is concerned, and for Russia and perhaps China, possibilities of gaining some foothold in Europe and in the Mediterranean. What do you think, as context, do you think that might be driving some of the events, and what do you think about possibilities?
Well, I think that you've nailed it. I think that's probably the main thing that's driving this. I mean, like you said before, there really weren't a lot of possibilities. I remember headlines from 4 years ago. The Russians were already saying that they could completely bail out Greece. So this has been something that's like been in the works for almost half a decade. They've been talking about this, and Russia has had its eye on Greece and the related geopolitical intrigues for quite some time. I think that some of the constituencies that you mentioned are that want out of the EU are not a majority, but they are a large segment of the society. The tricky thing is that they tend to be divided among the far right and the far left.
Right.
Even though, you know, the economic program of, say, Golden Dawn is almost identical to that of the Communist Party of Greece, not in Syriza, but the KKE.
Right.
So it's sort of one of those weird things, right? But, you know, the driving force are these, you know, you have the BRICS New Development Bank now. And, you know, this has been something that had been in the works for a long time. When Russia talked about bailing out Greece half a decade ago, when these problems really first were, I guess, left on their doorstep by Germany and Brussels, you know, they were probably already thinking that it was going to involve capital from India, capital from China, and based upon investments in Brazil. So this kind of new development bank kind of already existed conceptually, and the capital flows were already there. So you can see, you know, what is Greece going to do? I mean, we are looking at strange things because, you know, Merkel and Hollande made a statement today, the 8th of April, saying that they were okay with it. If Greece can get some refinancing from Russia, that it would be okay. And this seemed to be at odds with what some of the ministers from these governments have said, which seemed to be more in line with U.S. policy and Brussels policy. But it looks like there's some chinks in this EU thing.
Yeah, and they're based in some fundamental issues of sovereignty on the one hand, although I don't think that's driving it. That's kind of a political context for it. But more importantly, in terms of finance and economics, you know, Europe, the EU members, most of them were more or less dragged into the sanctions regime against Russia, for example. And many businesses across Europe took a pretty good hit over that, including some farmers in Greece. And they're not happy about it. And that happened, you know, they took that hit in the context of the overall, at best, malaise of the EU zone economy. And so now we see suddenly Russia, which had done reciprocal sanctions that had hurt Greek farmers, as I just mentioned, for example, saying to Greece, well, we can help you out by taking you off the sanctions list and allowing you to sell your goods here. You know, to some of the other countries that like Spain and others that are having problems, that's got to look all by itself pretty attractive.
You know, it is not only really attractive to look at, but when you consider that a lot of these large agribusinesses in Greece are publicly traded companies, I mean, just talking about it, you know, allowed a lot of the stock owners to regain nominal value they had lost in the value of stock, because just talking about it created, you know, speculation and hype.
Right.
It looks like something that might happen, but I think that some of the, you know, pageantry that we saw with Tsipras and Putin sitting down, and, you know, Lavrov and his counterpart sat down, and it was on live streaming TV across the world. Now, this is, you know, like a clear message to investors and to stock owners that things are turning around.
Yeah, you know that that's the kind of live stream that was up on a screen somewhere down on Wall Street, for example, today on the floor.
Exactly, big time.
Yeah. You know, there's also a history here, and you know, maybe we can seg into talking about the other item that I wanted to get to with you, which has to do with the politics around world, basically, it's almost like reframing World War II. It seems like that's what the United States and some members of the EU are trying to do. And you can't blame Germany for wanting to do that, of course. But currently, as Russia and Greece talk, there are people still alive from the World War II and post-war period in Greece, and certainly their children are still alive, that remember that Greece was one of the very few European countries that threw off the Nazis on their own partisans drove them out of the country before the Brits got there, before the Russians or Americans or anybody else could really help them. And those partisans were led by the communists, and the Communist Party was a very powerful force in Greek society, like in Yugoslavia, by the way, in the post-war period. Unlike Yugoslavia, though, Greece's revolution was thwarted by first the Brits, and then Harry Truman jumped in with both feet, declaring the Truman Doctrine there, and ushered in a period of a couple of decades of overt military fascist rule and legacy things that remain today, including outstanding war reparations from Germany, which are being raised for the first time at a sum that's actually greater than the total Greek debt to the EU and the other institutions, and pointing to the fact that Germany itself was forgiven a huge load of debt by, among others, Greece back in the early 1950s as a consequence of World War II. Tsipras raised the question of reparations. A lot of international observers kind of poo-pooed it, but it is a way of stating a case for total repudiation, only not as a as a deadbeat default creditor, but rather as a collection agent on something owed to the country.
Right, exactly.
It's as if, though, there's no institutional memory of all of that stuff after World War II, and now we're seeing actual affirmative rewrites of it coming out of places like Kiev and Washington. So
right.
So go ahead.
Well, you've got like the Latvians, Lithuanians, the Poles, and the Ukrainians, have tried to introduce legislation in our own countries to kind of, make it look like that the Nazi occupation was followed by a Soviet occupation instead of the framing it in terms of liberation from Nazism. There are arguments to be made. I mean, it's a matter of perspective and ideology, but they are really trying to reframe World War II, and it's been quite grotesque in Ukraine. In Greece, you had the partisan struggle, ousted the Nazi military government in Greece, and then of course the Brits basically backed the Nazis. A lot of people don't really know that.
In Greece.
And the partisans, were sort of unable to move. But I think with this new call coming about to basically make reparations from the war is something that there's a legal basis for it, and I think that it probably won't go anywhere in the EU. But it really, I think, solidifies the Greek public around that. Now, one thing that's kind of interesting is that there's a lot of misperceptions about, say, Golden Dawn in Greece, which is considered like a neo-Nazi party, but they actually oppose the German occupation from World War II, and they also support the call for reparations. So does the NL party, which is the other far right-wing party that's also sometimes called neo-Nazi, which actually is in a coalition government with Syriza, who people call far left. Right. So it's a really strange thing that's happening. It's kind of like there's a reframing of World War II happening from the NATO sphere, and then there's like a reframing of World War II happening in these spheres of resistance too, which kind of pose a lot of confusing questions and don't frame things in comfortable ways, at least for those of us who have a solid narrative of the 20th century. But, in practical terms, Don, I think it's like this. You've got an unpayable debt. It was structured to be unpayable. And I think it makes sense to bring up this issue of reparations because it really, if they can galvanize the public around that, then for sure they've galvanized the public around, say, a Grexit or any number of things. Now, on a purely legal basis, I'm pretty certain that the agreement with Germany was that they wouldn't be involved in West Germany, was that West Germany wouldn't have to make reparation payments under the U.S.'s watch until Germany was unified again. Now, that event happened, in 1989, and ever since then, actually, I think the agreement legally is that Germany does owe Greece.
Yeah. And it's interesting because when Syriza was elected, and as Syriza rose, really, because 2 years ago, the writing was on the wall, even.
Definitely.
You've seen the rise of Podemos in Spain, and You could hear the teeth chattering Brussels and Berlin and elsewhere over the possibility of a Syriza type phenomenon sweeping South Europe, Central Europe. The next election, if memory serves, is Spain's later this year. And people had been thinking, if Syriza can hang out and then Spain elects Podemos, that there's going to be, some unity between the two over these issues and a stronger case made at the table. But Spain doesn't have the same historical legacy with respect to World War II. They don't have the same debt owed to them by Germany, because they had their own indigenous fascist government that endured until like 1970 or something, right?
Right.
So I'm wondering if a smarter head at the table in, up in Berlin might be thinking, hey, if we write the debt off, but we don't say we're writing the debt off, but rather settling up our World War II claims, then there's no unity of interest anymore between Greece and Spain. And maybe we head off the spread of this as an epidemic. What do you think of that?
I think that if I were in charge of the ECB and was calling shots for the Troika, that's exactly what I would do. But what I've seen from these people is that they seem to be, of course, you've got the French bank, Agricole, and you've got, Deutsche Bank, and a lot of these banks tied up with the ECB. But they're also tied up with the same banks behind the IMF, and that makes the Troika. And I think that the problem is you've got the Americans involved, and they are just running a somewhat complex strategy of trying to keep the EU on an anti-Russia policy, which is really against the EU's Eurasian interests. And it seems like the Atlanticist faction in the EU is really, really just, going to railroad this, and it's like they're trying to make it break. I don't know if it has to do with nepotism or they've got the wrong people with a lack of vision. I mean, there's a lot of careerists and, people who went to the right schools and said, yes, teacher, and stuff like that. But, they're not necessarily people that have the most expansive, out-of-the-box thinking patterns. So I'm a little cautious, I'm reluctant to think that they would go for that. I mean, you're spot on. That would be the way to approach it if they were thinking straight. But I'm a little skeptical that they're able to think straight.
And finally, you had the oil ministers from Venezuela and Ecuador a month or two ago. It's almost 2 months now. Go to Moscow and meet with the oil ministers there and the foreign minister, if memory serves, Lavrov. And then they went to Athens and met with people from the Syriza government. You see any models there or any potential alliances there?
Well, I think that when we look at how I do see them, and I think that when we look at how the fluctuations in oil prices have hit oil economies particularly hard, Venezuela for one, Russia for one, I think that it inspired not just looking at, say, in the case of developing countries in Latin America, how they might restructure their debt or repudiate their debt, as in the case with Kirchner in Argentina. But I think they also are looking at models from the 1930s, income substitution industrialization. That's been all the news in Russia ever since the ruble took its initial hit, that they were going to go on a 2-3 year path of ISI. And I think that, this is sort of an alternate universe to globalization, because in globalization, we were told that, country A makes the bolts and the other guys make the gears and country C assembles it, right, and country D eats it.
Right.
But I think it's, we're looking at a kind of a segue into a uncharted territory where countries are going to be able to use the latest technologies to really round out their economies. I mean, there's still a natural unequal distribution of mineral resources. But that barring that, you've got a lot of capacity for countries like Venezuela to produce their own cars, their own electronics, their own, so on and so forth. So why wouldn't they? And it would solve issues of employment, of brain drain, retention, of, investment in universities and so forth, roads, infrastructure, and technology. So It's I think there's models that are happening, you know, going back to the last century, really.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.